It's the confluence where the news comes together at 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, thousands participated in Sunday's Women's March in Pittsburgh with a theme of power to the polls. What actions and their potential impact are next? Racism has been in the news recently, whether from alleged comments from the president or even an editorial in the Post-Gazette, but it's a topic that some are hesitant to discuss. Well, we're going to discuss a new project by our partners Public Source titled Let's Talk About Race. But first, in a landmark decision, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has ruled that the state's congressional district map is unconstitutional. There are cases of gerrymandering before the U.S. Supreme Court currently. We're going to discuss the impact of Pennsylvania's high court decision and how the U.S. Supreme Court could impact Pennsylvania's congressional map with Christian Farias, a legal columnist for New York Magazine. He's also legal editor with Radiolab's More Perfect. Welcome back to the show, Christian.
Thank you for having me and for being on the show again.
In studio is Mike Wershig, an investigative reporter for The Caucus, the weekly print-only newspaper covering Pennsylvania politics and state government. Good to see you, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
As always, your input is welcome. Tweet your comments and questions. Please use the hashtag WESAConfluence. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court's ruling came about 2 weeks after federal court judges ruled that Pennsylvania's congressional district map is constitutional. That's the U.S. Constitution. Mike, what are the plaintiffs in this federal case? What have they been claiming?
Well, the plaintiffs are claiming we're seeing this the similar claims in a lot of cases across the country, challenging maps in a bunch of states, most notably Wisconsin, which the Supreme Court is currently considering. What the plaintiffs are saying is that essentially by chopping up these districts in such a way that you're trying to give one party an advantage over another, that you are, in effect, diluting the value or diluting the power of some people's votes. You're making some votes less important than others, which, among other principles, violates the one person, one vote rule.
Okay, so the federal court here in Pennsylvania denied the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs are appealing that ruling to the Supreme Court. Now, Christian, is this Pennsylvania federal case, the federal case, is that similar to what the justices are already considering, or are there differences?
It's actually similar and different, and it's very important to keep the cases separated. There's a whole mess of cases involving not just Pennsylvania, but also Wisconsin and Maryland dealing with this issue that is known as partisan gerrymandering, which is the drawing of districts to advantage one party over the other, and whether that is constitutional. And where the confusion lies is that right now the federal constitution does not contemplate this kind of case. The Supreme Court has never said, yes, you cannot do that. Yes, that is unconstitutional. And for that reason, you have these efforts at the ground level, especially in Pennsylvania. You have it at the federal district level, where the court said exactly what I just told you. No, there's no such a thing. But then at the state level, you have the Pennsylvania Supreme Court saying the opposite. Yes, there is such a thing under our own constitution. The federal constitution may not recognize that you cannot draw district lines, create congressional maps based on the party that you want to favor, but the state constitution does, and we're going to protect voters under our own founding charter.
Now, in the federal case, Pennsylvania, federal case, I want to get to that state Supreme Court ruling of this week. The federal court in Pennsylvania ruled in favor of Republican lawmakers who said the claim was a political question, not the courts to decide. Christian, is that the basic argument? Is that one of the arguments of defendants in these gerrymandering cases, that it's the purview of the legislative branch and not the judicial in how to draw maps?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a question that courts have been dealing with since the 60s. And it's basically, can courts insert themselves into these highly politicized cases? Can basically judges decide elections? That we saw that question in the Bush v. Gore case. And courts for a long time have been reluctant, but since the 60s, they've been wading into these waters and deciding these cases for the very reason that you cannot discriminate against people, say, on the basis of race. And if a state or its lawmakers won't recognize that. Someone has to decide that, and that's when courts step in. Now, this new question of partisan gerrymandering is newer, and it's so far not settled. And for that reason, we're seeing all these battles play out, because now that lawmakers know that they cannot separate voters on the basis of race, they're searching for other means. They're relying on numbers. They're relying on statistical formulas that may not be readily recognized by the law, but when you look at the impact that it's having on the electorate, it's almost as if the legislators are picking their voters rather than the other way around.
Right, and Justice Kennedy left some room open for these challenges that are currently coming forward in a 2004 decision when he concurred with the majority, saying that it was actually upholding Pennsylvania's 2,000 congressional districts. And what he said was, he sided with the majority in that he didn't throw out the maps, but his reasoning was that because there is no, he couldn't come up with a standard that other legislatures should follow. And because there is no standard, there is no way to say this map is unconstitutional. One of the reasons this has come to a head is because modern computing power makes it much easier to tailor these districts down to the block and lot level, the census block and lot level. It is micro targeting in a sense. I mean, you're tailoring the districts in a very specific way that you just weren't able to do before.
Okay, so let's get now to what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled this week. Case was filed in state court, not federal court. Mike, what was briefly the argument of the plaintiffs here?
The argument is similar to what they were the plaintiffs across the country are arguing.
But it violated the Pennsylvania Constitution.
Exactly. And the Pennsylvania Constitution has a lot of provisions that are similar to the federal Constitution, a couple that are actually identical to the federal Constitution. But they brought this as a matter of state law, not as a matter of federal law. And because of that, you end up on these separate tracks. And that's why you have these competing decisions.
Okay. So the high court ruled that the currently drawn map, quote, clearly, plainly, and palpably violates the state constitution, end quote. Christian, when you were following all these cases, when you heard that ruling, were you surprised at all? What was your reaction?
I was pleasantly surprised because it's a state law decision, it's not a federal law decision. That means whatever the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said is the rule, is the law of the land in Pennsylvania. And there's very little chance that a higher court, in this case the U.S. Supreme Court, can go and overturn it. The Supreme Court is very reluctant to mess with state law if there isn't an independent federal law ground that it can look at. But because the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is very careful to only rule on a state law basis, then there's very little chance that the Supreme Court is going to take it. Matter of fact, I mean, there's an appeal now of this ruling before the Supreme Court. It's a long shot. I don't think, I mean, don't quote me, but I'm almost certain that the Supreme Court is not going to bother with it because it is based on state law. And whenever that's the reasoning, the justices don't mess with it, and they let the lower court decision, in this case the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision, to stand, which means that under it, Pennsylvania will very soon have new congressional maps.
Okay, so let me follow up on that with both of you. The Republicans, in their appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, said the question of what does and does not constitute a legislative function under the Elections Clause is a question of federal, not state law, and this court, meaning the U.S. Supreme Court, is the arbiter of that distinction. Christian, first you, then Mike on that. What are the chances if that's the crux to their argument?
I mean, that's very much the argument, or similar at least, to what the plaintiffs, or George Bush in this case, tried to do in Bush v. Gore. I mean, it was a state recount. It was entirely based on the rules of the state of Florida, but they tried to make a federal case out of it, and the Supreme Court bought it, and the rest is history. I don't think the court is going to take that same route this time. The stakes aren't as high as a presidential election. And for that reason, I think it's a long shot, and I don't think he has a chance.
Mike?
Yeah, I'm probably not the person you want to ask about handicapping court decisions, but it is the Republicans, when they appealed this to the U.S. Supreme Court, they said that, yes, the state Supreme Court says it plainly and palpably violates the state constitution. The thing is, they didn't actually identify which part of the constitution it violates. There still is no opinion issued. There's an order, but there is no opinion explaining why the order was issued.
Okay, so I want to get to a couple things. Now, the state Supreme Court, Pennsylvania Supreme Court, also ordered the legislature to redraw the map in a very quick time and the governor to sign it in a quick time. Otherwise, Pennsylvania Supreme Court would basically take over the map drawing. Mike, you covered state government. Can the legislature get anything done that quickly?
Well, technically, yes. Now, they've got 2 weeks, or 2 weeks from today. The legislature has to submit its new map to the governor by February 9th. After that, the governor has to submit it, has to reject or uphold it, sign it by February 15th, and then the plan becomes available by the 19th. So 2 weeks seems like a pretty short time to do this, but earlier this week, I hopped online and found a web app that allows you to redraw congressional districts, and it's very detailed. It took me about 4 hours. I was plodding along.
Okay, so it's all over then.
Well, that's the fact that you can do it in 4 hours doesn't necessarily mean that you should.
Right.
But the legislature can, I think, if pushed, pull this off because they've been doing this a lot.
Okay, Christian, I want to ask you, we have just 2 minutes left. I want to ask you, is this similar to what was ordered in North Carolina? Because North Carolina legislators were ordered to redraw the map, were they not?
Yes, and North Carolina is another state that historically has a lot of gerrymandering issues, both racially and now, we're seeing these new political gerrymandering claims. It's very similar. Right now there is an appeal before the Supreme Court with respect to North Carolina. And North Carolina has very high power attorneys, private counsel, who have had a lot of luck before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in fact, has agreed to put a stop to some of this map drawing until they review the underlying court decisions. And that's still touch and go. We don't know what's going to happen. But there's a lot of uncertainty right now in North Carolina. And that's one thing that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, tends to be really deferential to. Will order to redraw the maps cause chaos in the electorate? And, of course, the state will try to make that case. Oh, no, the courts cannot order us to do this because all the voters are going to be confused. There are ways to manage elections. These people are professionals many times. And the question is, are the justices willing to cure a constitutional violation that harms voters, or are they more concerned with the orderliness of how a state proceeds with the electoral process? I think more often than not, we would like the courts to err on the side of the voters rather than the state so as to cure the constitutional violation.
All right, Christian. And Mike, very briefly, I know you're working on a major cover story for the caucus on this whole issue. What's the essence of it?
Well, we're trying to see, where this decision leaves us and where things are going to head from here. Pennsylvania, if this decision stands, which it looks like it probably will, is not the only one that rejects partisan gerrymandering. There are 4 states that specifically outlawed in their own state laws. There are 10 states that say you can't use the redistricting process to protect incumbents.
We'll look forward to that story. Mike Wershagen's an investigative reporter for the caucus, and Christian Farias is a legal columnist for the New York Magazine and a legal editor with Radio Lab's More Perfect. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Coming up, the word racism tossed around frequently, but do we really ever talk about it? That's coming up in a few minutes on The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Sunday's Women's March in Pittsburgh coincided with dozens of similar marches around the world, bringing together thousands of people, filling 3 city blocks. Who came? Who organized it? What can we expect to see in the year to come? We'll get answers to those questions and more with reporter Virginia Alvino Young, who covers identity and justice for WESA. Welcome back to the show, Virginia.
Thanks, Kevin.
So, Virginia, tell us about the day. What was the energy? What was the message?
It was a really nice day out. I think that helped some folks come to downtown Pittsburgh for sure. But I mean, it was a really large group, a lot of ages represented, men and women, not a ton of diversity in terms of the attendees. But, you know, people really coming out in droves, bringing their kids out, and the message which comes down from the national organization, the theme of this year's event being power to the polls. So a real emphasis, not just on reacting maybe to decisions from the election, like last year's march, perhaps, but really saying we're going to take action, we're going to organize, we're going to rally around transforming elections specifically.
Okay, so you mentioned maybe not the most amount of diversity. Last year, there were two separate events.
Yes.
This year, one, I know you spoke with the march organizer prior to the event. This march, was it more unified or not?
The issue with the idea of unity is that it's always going to be an issue in social organizing. You look historically at the issue of organizing, and there's always going to be different ways to set agendas, different people with different priorities. And when it comes to racial diversity, this is what happened last year, is that the organizers weren't the most experienced from the Women's March. It was largely white women, and based on what they were seeing on social media, you know, there were accusations that this is an event for white feminists. And without that idea of intersectionality, recognizing people and their other aspects of their identities, their particular needs, adversities, and priorities, that's where you had that split. This year, in terms of unity, it's not, okay, these two factions got together and rallied around the cause. No, there was just the one event, but there was an inclusive message coming from that event. You know, despite the lack of diversity in turnout, these are longtime Pittsburgh organizers, and the difference is they're really partnering with a broad coalition of organizers. So organizations in Pittsburgh that have been organizing for a long time, they're not just sort of jumping on now and saying, what can we do? It's leveraging these existing organizations that within their own communities work with diverse segments. And so that's where you get a little bit of a change. You know, it's not about unity, we're all just women. That's going to inherently be an exclusive type of priority. But it's more about, you know, what can we do together in terms of getting each of our own agendas onto the table? And that's where you get behind, you know, the message of changing elections.
We've been gearing up locally for a series of special elections, everything from city council to the state house to the 18th district in Congress. And that in addition to the midterm congressional elections. At the march, was there a greater emphasis on voting this time?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that is the emphasis, is who can we get into office, who is already sort of going to be an ally for these causes, and not just behind women's issues, but the issues that women care about. Women are people, not this monolithic block. So it's not just equal pay and, you know, getting sexual harassment being paid more attention to, and, you know, abortion rights. It's women care about the environment, women care about economic development. So who are they seeing as elected officials that are or that can affect the issues that they care about? So it's not just about who are these people, but getting more women into office, getting more diverse women into office, and also registering more people, but not just attendees. It's about sort of, okay, tapping into each one of these attendees. How can they go out into their circles, into their communities, and get more engagement there?
What about political involvement beyond the polls, going to vote?
The encouragement is to get trained. I mean, you know, organizers saying you better already be registered to vote if you're going to be taking this initial political action of marching in the streets. But it's really easy to become a voter registrar. It's really easy to do things like phone banking. And those are the types of things that people who marched last year say that even if that was their first march ever, that they've been doing throughout the last year, is those types of entry level political, you know, they're doing more canvassing. They're getting more involved even on off march days.
So what are the goals of the march organizers, the participants? What's their action plan to accomplish the goals? In other words, what do you see coming out of this movement in the months ahead?
I mean, first, what I would repeat is what the main organizer of the Women's March here in Pittsburgh, Tracy Baton, said to me when I asked about what do you do beyond just marching. And she brought attention to the fact that marching in and of itself has an inherent value. It brings people together, it gives people energy, and you really meet the people who you would be working with throughout the year. So you start to know each other, you start to understand one another. And so she would say that there's value in and of that action itself. Now, going forward, what do you do with that? it's whatever resonates with specific people, right? Not everyone is going to march and then run for elected office, but there are people at every level of political engagement. Maybe that means they're going to put up a yard sign, whereas they wouldn't have before. Maybe it means they're going to be doing some phone banking. And we heard from very young people, some even too young to vote, that they've already engaged with actions like that. And for some, it means tapping into that network, finding the resources, the allies, and the organizers who can get you into office.
Virginia Alvino-Young is WESA's identity and justice reporter. Virginia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, racism. It's a topic that some are hesitant to discuss, but Public Source is doing just that through a new project titled Let's Talk About Race. That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Rosie the Riveter died this week. Naomi Parker Fraley, believed by many to be the inspiration behind Rosie, died at the age of 96. However, multiple women have claimed to have inspired the iconic image created by Pittsburgh artist J. Howard Miller. And Pat Meehan will not seek another term. The Republican lawmaker came under scrutiny this week after it was revealed he settled a harassment claim involving a staffer 3 decades younger than him. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Charges of racism have arisen recently, whether they're surrounding statues, public images, or alleged comments by the president, or an editorial by the Post-Gazette. The term racism is tossed out there, but do we really talk about it? Joining us to discuss the ongoing project Let's Talk About Race is the managing editor for Public Source, Hallie Stockton. Great to see you again, Hallie.
Good to be here, Kevin.
And two of Public Source's first round contributors, Felicity Williams is an attorney and advocate for intersectional causes. Welcome, Felicity.
Thank you for having me.
And Brian Broom is a writer and recent graduate of Chatham University. Brian, so glad that you're with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as always, you're welcome to join the conversation. Tweet us your questions or comments and at the hashtag WESA Confluence. Okay, the project called Let's Talk About Race, a collection of videos, photos, essays, exploring how the Pittsburgh community perceives race and racial division. Hallie, for those who haven't seen it yet, tell us briefly what the stories look like online and why you decided to tell them the way you did.
Sure. So for listeners who haven't yet seen it, we photographed or recorded each of our 13 participants in a studio with the same gray background. And we also linked them together in a mosaic on a landing page. And the reason we chose to do that, not only to, you know, get away with some of those logistical problems or do away with those, but to also, you know, not have any distractions or background noise and to show that there's unity. There's a common thread among all these folks. And that is, you know, we're here in Pittsburgh and we need to have this conversation about race and racism. They're also linked up in a mosaic with different sized photos so that we're showing that there's overlapping lived experiences and that they affect one another.
Okay. Now, did you pursue the writers who had stories to tell? How did that come about?
We at Public Source, we did, yes. We did that through a talented freelancer, Brittany Haler. She contacted a lot of people who are known to be doing important work in this area, and you know, found people through referral, and spoke with those who felt, you know, very passionate about the issue and wanted to get out there and represent their opinion and also share their experience.
As I read the stories, as I looked at the videos, some of the stories are about policy or problem solving or how people of color encounter the world. But there are several that really describe raw emotions. They're uncomfortable, even dangerous situations. Brian, I want to bring you into the conversation. Mm-hmm. You wrote a lot about transition and discovery. Tell us a little bit about Ohio, what made you sure that Pittsburgh, at least in those early days, was different and might be better for you.
Well, when I was approached by Public Source, this story leapt to mind because as a child, I labored under the delusion that an urban environment would be more diverse, much more accepting. I grew up in rural Ohio, and I thought that by leaving that environment, I would, you know, and coming to a city, I would escape all that, to find that that's just not true. I encounter much of the same problems here that I do. That I did back in Ohio. So, and I am continually learning that as I stay in Pittsburgh.
And you described in your essay that Ohio, that part of Ohio that you experienced, was a racist cesspool. How long did it take you to sort of overcome your initial impressions of what Pittsburgh might be for you and then what it actually did become for you?
Not long. I had been here maybe about a year before I realized I hadn't really escaped anything. I just sort of ran into a new version of what I thought I'd left behind in Ohio. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, as I say, I'm continually learning that day by day. And I say in my essay, you know, we live in the shadow of Appalachia, and it turns out to be very true culturally in Pittsburgh a lot of times.
You described sort of a sense of guilt, a tremendous sense of guilt when you were younger for leaving home, later as an adult, after someone verbally harassed you on the street. How often do you think about those experiences? Do they affect the way you interact with people now?
Yes, absolutely. There's a trust issue, I think, in Pittsburgh among black people and white people. I say in the essay, black people and white people walk around in this city in two different worlds, and I believe that to be absolutely true.
All right, Felicity. Now, you are a native Pittsburgher. You grew up here.
Yes.
Right on the border, Pittsburgh and Wilkinsburg, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, but you left for a while to pursue other opportunities for yourself as a young black woman. So where did you go to find those opportunities, and what were the differences that you noticed there and here?
So I left to go to law school in Southern Virginia at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. After that, I went to work in the DMV, which is D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area. And that's kind of where I saw, just to be blunt and not as eloquent, black people doing stuff. And I think that was the difference between Pittsburgh, though that I believe that that is changing. There are things that I'm seeing now in Pittsburgh that I did not see even a year ago, especially with the young black population in Pittsburgh, that they are doing. And so to explain a little bit more about black people doing stuff.
Yes, please.
Yeah. Because that can be a very vague.
I assume you're meaning doing positive, productive stuff.
Yes. So, seeing black people in all levels of positions of power and seeing a lot of them, having that not be a rarity, or going out to brunch on a Sunday and seeing a large amount of black people in a restaurant having brunch, and it didn't matter what kind of restaurant it was, just seeing there's a different feeling about that and being in there and being surrounded by so many opportunities.
Does this speak to what you called the pro-black movement?
I think it does. Part of it because, in my article I talked about the difference between progressivism and pro-black and the difference between the equity and equality. And I talked about the shift in power and the representation and the lack of that. And seeing that in other cities, I think, is where we found that. Seeing that in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area is where we found that. When you see black people that are in positions of power in different industries, when you see more representation.
Are you still glad you came back to Pittsburgh, came home?
I am, because like I mentioned earlier, I see things that are happening now that I didn't even see a year ago. And I think that if there's nobody here making that change happen, forcing and demanding that change happens, it will never happen on its own. And so I am glad, and I am still hopeful, and I do see some progress, though we have a tremendous amount of work to do.
I'd like each of you to comment on this idea of equity versus equality. Let's start with you, Brian.
Equity versus equality. That's a good one. I tend to lean more on into the idea of equality. It's an essential idea. I think in order to achieve equity, you have to have this idea of what of equality. It's chilling to think about somebody just devaluing you based on these delusions of who they think they are and what they think you are. So I think those two things work in tandem. I don't necessarily know that they're separate things.
Hallie Stockton?
Sure. Until just this last year, really, the difference between equity and equality was unclear to me. And it's becoming a much more known distinction in not only the race issue, but when you look at even school, how schools are operating, different school districts. So it's not the same thing to just be, you know, handing out, oh, we're giving out the same amount to everyone and everything, but looking and considering the past and how much needs to be done for different groups of people or organizations to get everyone to the same point.
Right.
And Felicity.
Yeah, as I said in my article, you cannot achieve equality without equity. And I think of the analogy of if you're running a race and you are giving everyone the same amount of time, the same shoes, that's equality. But that assumes that we all start at the same starting point. And we know that we don't all start at the same starting point. Some people start behind the starting line. Some people start way ahead of the starting line. And so if we just give everybody the equal amount of time, we're not going to end up in the same place.
Okay. Several other people have participated in this. And let's hear from some of the voices that are participating in this project.
Why is this person treating me this way? And it's not because of how I speak, and it's not my education, and it's not my socioeconomics. When you start taking all that stuff away, what it comes down to is it must be what I look like or where I come from.
You might have heard about a lot of the accolades that we have about our wonderful city and how well Pittsburgh's doing and our new economy. And that's wonderful, although that seems to be only applying to the white people and not the people of color that live in our city.
Get out into these communities that have people that are not like you and work with them. Don't make it a thing where you're planning to have a conversation about race. That'll come. Just get out and be around them, be together, and do things together for the community.
It's kind of like we're soldiers, we're born soldiers into this American war.
Talking about race as if it was like a yes or no question. Like, is there a problem with racism in Pittsburgh? And people are like going to say no and then like stop the conversation there.
That was Adriana Ramirez, Kelly Rabenstein Donahoe, Matt Landis, Ciara Thomas, and Danny Janae. Hallie, public sources staff, not unlike WESA's or the city at large, is predominantly white. How did that affect you, how you listened and worked with your contributors?
Yeah, that's the truth. And we, as we continue to focus on addressing that, we're focused on the representation and how that affected how we worked with folks is, you know, we're lending our platform and we want to make sure that that there is representation. And so that really factored into the choice to make it a first person storytelling project.
Right. We have just about a minute left. Felicity and Brian, I want to get you. How have your families, friends, coworkers reacted to your essays?
My story is, kind of a painful story that I went through by myself, and I hadn't told my family about this story, and it was a surprise. My mother and my aunt couldn't believe that I had had this experience. I kept it to myself because I was ashamed of being attacked racially, which is an odd thing, but just shock.
Mm-hmm. And Felicity.
A lot of support, a lot of positivity. I'm actually just impressed and surprised, to be honest, about some of it. So just been really supportive.
All right. Very quickly, each of you, does Pittsburgh need more conversation or is there enough conversation and it's time for direct action? Felicity, just right down the line.
Direct action.
All right.
Direct action.
Absolutely. Action is what we need. We need everyone talking about this so that we can figure out what the right action is.
All right. Hallie, how can people get in touch with the project very quickly?
Hallie@publicsource.org. That's Halle@publicsource.org.
Hallie Stockton is the managing editor for Public Source. Felicity Williams is a native Pittsburgher, attorney and advocate in the city. And Brian Broom is a writer, recent graduate of Chatham University. Thanks for all being here.
Thank you.
Coming up, multi-million-dollar settlement is paid to the victim of a Pittsburgh police officer involved shooting. Meantime, the state prison population is dropping, but not for all groups. That's coming up on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Catherine Baker Knowles is sworn in as Pennsylvania's first ever and still only female lieutenant governor in 2003. The McKees Rocks Democrat served under Governor Ed Rendell. With experience in the state treasury, Knowles was known for her involvement in economic development issues. She died at age 78 in 2008. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for January 26, 2018.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A multi-million dollar settlement in an officer-involved shooting. A young man is sentenced to decades in prison for a mass stabbing at a local school. And the number of inmates are on the decline at Pennsylvania prisons. We're going to talk about all of that with Megan Guza, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line with us is University of Pittsburgh law professor and host of the podcast Criminal Injustice, David Harris. Hello, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin. Hi, Megan.
Hey there.
The city of Pittsburgh agreed to pay $5.5 million in a settlement to Leon Ford, who was shot and paralyzed by Pittsburgh police at a traffic stop in 2012. Megan, let's start with a brief recap of what happened.
Sure. Nighttime, November 11th, 2012. Leon Ford is driving through Highland Park. He was pulled over by some City of Pittsburgh police, possibly for a traffic violation. You know, it's always been back or forth whether he was actually speeding or not. And what happened here was really a case of mistaken identity. Police were looking for a gentleman by the name of Lamont Ford. Leon Ford identified himself to officers, and they really just didn't believe him, didn't believe the name on his license. And just as quickly as everything started, one of the officers tried to drag Leon Ford from the car. Car lurched forward, and one of the officers, saying he feared for his life as the car started moving, fired his weapon, hit Ford five times. He ended up paralyzed.
One other fact to add is that that police officer jumped into the car. He was not inside the car. He jumped in as it started to roll away, and it was only then that he said he feared for his life.
All right. The family, David, wound up filing a federal lawsuit. Is that correct? And the jury deadlocked, I believe, in October?
That's right, Kevin. They did file a federal lawsuit over this. The lawsuit was tried. There was a mistrial in the sense that it did not come to a final verdict on the one officer. And the settlement is what has resulted after that one trial.
Mayor Peduto called the deal an amicable resolution that will provide closure. What has the family said, or even Leon Ford's attorney?
Leon Ford has made a public statement saying that this is what he wanted and he was satisfied with it.
And I know the family has also said that, you know, they're just happy that this is over. And I imagine the city of Pittsburgh also feels the same way.
When you talk to people in the city, especially in the African-American community, they put this case in the same category as others that have come along periodically. Jordan Miles, you know, those other cases. All of them have the same meaning to a lot of the people in the community, that the police have crossed a line and have done something violent or taken a life, whatever it is. And Leon Ford's case now sits squarely in that history for a lot of people in Pittsburgh.
David, I want to ask you about the settlement itself. Seems like a lot of money, $5.5 million, but is that unusual? Do we see other cities paying out millions and millions? And I understand that even some cities budget for this kind of thing.
Well, that's right, Kevin. We've talked some about that on the podcast in Criminal Injustice. Some cities, this kind of conduct, unfortunately, is much more common even than it is in Pittsburgh, and they do have to budget for it. One thing that we should notice, I mean, $5.5 million, that's not small change to a city like Pittsburgh. It is something that taxpayers should all think about. What would we do with this with that amount of money as taxpayers, as a city? And when we have to spend it to compensate somebody who's been paralyzed and will have needs for the rest of his life because of a very brief encounter with our police, when he had done really nothing except show them his license and his insurance papers, which were all in order, that amount of money is now no longer available to the citizens of Pittsburgh for other things.
Meanwhile, the resolution of another case in Pittsburgh this week, 20-year-old Alex Reibel was sentenced this week to 23.5 to 60 years in prison for the mass stabbing at Franklin Regional High School. That was 4 years ago when he was 16 years old. Rivals stabbed 20 fellow students. Four were critically injured, and a security guard was injured as well. All of the victims survived. So, David, Rybal was tried as an adult. Was that rare?
It is usually reserved for the most serious crimes, especially homicides. But a judge does have some discretion, and the prosecution can move, even when they don't have a statute in back of them, can move to transfer a case from the juvenile to the adult system. The juvenile system is designed with the one idea in mind, and that is that kids are different. Kids grow, kids change, their brains develop, they can be rehabilitated. And this trying kids as an adult method has gotten, unfortunately, in my opinion, much more common over the past two decades than it ever used to be. And Alex Rybal, he committed a very serious crime. There were some serious injuries. But the kid was 16, and there were substantial mental health issues that were also testified about. So having him in the adult system, I think, was open to question, and I think that will be the key appeal issue as the case goes forward from this point.
Speaking of mental health, the defense wanted to plead guilty but mentally ill. Briefly, what would that have meant, and why did the judge reject that idea?
The judge may have rejected it because he did not feel that Rybal met the definition, the legal definition of mental illness or insanity. But that is strictly a legal matter. It's not a medical matter in the sense that a person can still be mentally ill even if they don't meet that legal standard. What it would have meant if the judge had granted that would have been that Alex Rybal would have been in a mental health facility at least until age 21, or he became well, his mental illness resolved, which didn't seem like it was likely to happen. And then something else would happen to him. But he would get serious mental health treatment in a mental health facility, and that's not going to happen now. He may get some mental health treatment, but it'll be in prison.
At the sentencing hearing, Rybal's father tried to bring the mental health issues back up again, said his son suffered from depression as a result of bullying. Megan, it seemed like the DA, John Peck, was downplaying the idea of bullying.
He did. What he essentially said was, you know, we all went through something like this. We were all bullied to a degree. High school is hard. And the judge did the same thing. He discounted the bullying theory, saying there was no evidence that Rybal was actually bullied. I believe what he actually said was the facts don't support it. I haven't been able to find an explanation of what exactly the facts don't support it means, but that was something they continually downplayed, you know, throughout the entire trial and the sentencing.
So what sort of mental health treatment might he get?
Well, since he will now be in an irregular adult prison for at least 23 years, he'll get some mental health treatment, but prisons are not set up to deliver mental health treatment, even though they have high numbers and percentages of mentally ill inmates, especially in county jails, but even in prisons. They are not there to do that. So he'll get some treatment. I don't think he is going to get anything like he could get in a real mental health facility. And the thing is, he's going to get out someday. He will be out. And even if that's a long time from now, I think he, not just him, though, everybody has an interest in having him treated so that when he does get out, he's no longer a danger and he can live some kind of life.
Alex Rybal enters the prison system at a time when the inmate population is on the decline for a fourth straight year. The total state prison system population dropped by about 800 in the past year to a little more than 48,000. So why, I guess, why 4 years in a row? Crime rate, is it down? Alternative sentencing kicking in? What about that Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling about mandatory minimums?
This is significant that the growth is kind of plateauing. It's going down a little, but 800 out of 48,000, I mean, we can all do the math. It's not that big a drop. And it has to do with all those different factors, the demographics of people in the crime-prone ages, the use of other kinds of sentences, the striking down of mandatory minimums. We have been in a low-crime era for better than 20 years now, and yet our populations have continued to go up. What if we really want those populations to go down significantly, though, we have to stop putting so many people in. I mean, I guess that's obvious, but our legislatures don't always get that message. And especially, we have to think much harder about the length of sentences we give. There's an episode of our podcast up, Criminal Injustice, this week, and a gentleman from the Urban Institute, Ryan King, he talks about how the real driver of prison populations is not the short to medium sentences, it's the super long sentences, the life without parole, the 25, 35, 40 years. If we want to make a difference, we have to talk about that.
So overall, the numbers have gone down for four straight years. Megan, you just reported, however, the number of women inmates has actually risen.
Right, it has. The overall drop works out to about 1%, which is small, but in the era of overcrowding and prisons all over, any drop is a bit of a difference. But on the other end of that, the female population has actually gone up by a little over 1.5%. And there's a lot of talk about whether that could be attributed back to the opioid epidemic. You know, not just being in jail for drug charges, but everything that comes with it, whether it be charges of prostitution, of theft.
Why is it a factor? Do we know? Are we learning anything?
Well, I mean, it's so widespread that it touches every demographic.
Finally, an update on the Bill Cosby case. David Cosby was out and about in Philadelphia last weekend doing some stand-up again. Some legal experts have indicated it's a PR strategy. What do you think?
It's definitely a PR strategy, Kevin. There's no other good reason for it. I mean, what you want with a client in a position like this is for the client to actually stay quiet in the best of all circumstances, to not be in a position to do or say anything embarrassing. But Cosby's case is so well known, and his situation is actually getting worse, not better, that this is, to me, this is kind of a Hail Mary pass. I mean, he's out there to do this to try to improve his image in the potential jury pool because there's really no alternative. I mean, he had a mistrial last year. He came close to being convicted, and now he has the Me Too movement hanging over that whole trial. And if nobody sees that, I'd be really surprised. So his position is actually worse than it was. That's why they've sent him out on this kind of charm offensive to re-ingratiate himself with the public and remind everybody that he's that nice guy, that funny comedian.
The Me Too movement involved because it is a sexual assault trial. David, one final question. With the first trial ending in a mistrial, the prosecution wants to call 19 additional accusers. Is this an attempt to just sort of overwhelm the jury to show the accusers all can't be wrong?
Well, the judge won't let it happen for that reason. And I'm skeptical that the judge will let in that many in the first place. Remember, for the first trial, they proposed bringing in a dozen other victims. And the judge, I think, only allowed one or maybe two of them to testify. And he very carefully limited the purpose for which the jury could consider their testimony. And it'll do the same thing. The jury is to try the case in front of it and not Mr. Cosby's character. So the judge will limit the number, I predict, and tell the jury very strictly they can only consider it for the limited purpose, that testimony of, say, this is how Mr. Cosby operates. This is his MO, not for he's a bad guy or has a bad character.
David Harris is a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh and the host of the Criminal Justice Podcast. And Megan Guza is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure, Kevin.
And finally, on last week's show, we talked about Pittsburgh making the cut, down to 20 cities still in the running to host Amazon's second headquarters. And once again, Pittsburgh leaders then refused to disclose details about what is in their application to Amazon. Now they might have to do so. Wednesday, Pennsylvania's Office of Open Records ruled that the city of Pittsburgh and Allegheny County must make public the region's bid for Amazon's second headquarters. The Office of Open Records decision compels the city and county to release the proposal within 30 days to local TV station WTAE. City and county have 30 days to appeal the office's decision. City and county officials say they are reviewing that decision. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Research from Zakiya Madian. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.